When we arrived in Europe, the army, the division that arrived in Europe, I was a captain. And these promotions, from lieutenant to captain, are pretty much routine. If you're in for a certain period of time, you get to be a captain. And when we arrived there, the assistant division chaplain had taken sick, and we didn't see him anymore. We never did find out what happened to him. And we were told we have a new assistant division chaplain coming up. And the first time I saw him, he was drunk. And it didn't take long before he was removed. And it was necessary then to have a new assistant division chaplain. The assistant division chaplain becomes a major automatically. And one of the Christian chaplains was so sure that he was going to be promoted, and anyway, he had a girlfriend there, an Austrian girlfriend, and the very bad part about it was, see, a chaplain had his own soldier, his Jeep driver, yeah, his own Jeep driver. Of course, I had a Jewish driver, and you became the assistant division chaplain, you became a major, and so this soldier, this officer, for some reason or other, just assumed that he would be the assistant division chaplain. So much so, and he's a Christian minister with a wife at home, he was sleeping with this girl. And as I started to say, the bad things about it was that his driver was a very clean-cut, very religious boy. And it was his job to take the chaplain to the girlfriend's house every evening and pick him up the next morning. And of course, he was a married man, and we all knew that. Of course, I couldn't say anything to him. No, I guess nobody else did. In any event, he was so sure that he was going to get the job, and he told his girlfriend that she went out and bought a major's insignia for him. And because this was, I'd been working with the DPs, and the general was very pleased with my work, because in the next division, the other division, I don't know whether they had a Jewish chaplain or not, but they had plenty of trouble there. And I was able to keep things running on a cooler, even keel. And the general,
when you say they had a lot of trouble, what do you mean?
You know, I've never had so much sorrow as I had in my life, as I had with the Jews there.
During the army period? During your army period?
Not the Jewish soldiers.
Oh, the displaced.
No, displaced persons. They were impossible. And, you know, in the army, everything has to be kept clean. There's inspections all the time. And the Jews would not keep the quarters clean. You know, they took over hotels.
These people that you saved from concentration camps.
Yeah, they were moved. That's another story of how they got there. So maybe I'll tell you. But they didn't keep the quarters clean. And in the army, you have to, there are inspections all the time. I remember one soldier came to me and actually crying. He says, "Chaplain, you've got to help me." He says, "The general is coming to inspect." And he says, "There's shit all over the place, on the ceilings even, in their rooms." And he says, "And it's going to be my neck." So I dashed out, and it just happened by coincidence that that day I had, the general gave me a medal for my work there. And I was wearing my dress uniform, you know, they have the parade, you know, so you wear your best uniforms. And I called the people together. We had a big open field in front of this hotel.
And where was this hotel? In Germany?
In Austria.
In Austria.
Yeah, we were in Austria at that time. And I called the people all together. I had people go in and summon them all out of their rooms. And I told them that the general was coming, and we got to clean the place up. Their answer was, we worked enough when we were in the concentration camp. We're not going to work now. And I wept. I pleaded with them. And I said, look, we can't ask these Goyish boys here to clean up our dreck. I said, we've got to do it. Wir haben genug gearbeitet und KZ in concentration camp. So I said, okay, I said, the general gave me a medal today. I'm going to celebrate by cleaning up your dreck. And I was wearing my dress uniform, started taking my uniform off, the jacket off. And they stood there and watched me, except for two young boys who ran up and grabbed me. And they said, no rabbi is going to clean up our dreck. And, I mean, this is the type of thing that happened from time to time, where I was almost ready to commit suicide. you might
it was
say.
Such a problem.
Oh, yes.
So isn't it ironic that the people that you saved were the ones that gave you serious problems?
Yeah, well, you know, when we had occasionally, we'd have shalichim, as they call them, emissaries from Israel who would come, and they saw what was going on, and they said, well, we've got to get them to Israel, we'll make mention out of them there. You know, I hesitate to say some of these things because it's blackening our own people, but I remember a member of the, what's the, in Israel, the Jewish agency came. See, the war was over by that time. They came, and this man, a very fine man, got word to me that he'd like to have lunch with me. So I met with him. And he said,
yes, you can go ahead. Go ahead, take whatever license you want. It's going to be edited anyway.
Where was I?
This man wanted to have lunch with you.
Yes. So we're sitting having lunch, and he said to me, you know, I can't believe what I hear about you. And I realized that it wasn't good. I said, well, what do you hear about me? And I have to preface with this. When the displaced persons arrived, you know, the expression, upgerissen, upgeschlissen, you know, in rags, a lot of them, and so on. My job as a chaplain, I wasn't only working with the Jewish people, I had to take care of the American
soldiers
too.
Yeah.
So I was with my Jeep driver, and I would travel around the whole area of Austria, practically. And wherever we would go, I would have services with the Jewish boys, and then I would tell them about the terrible conditions of the Jews have been in the concentration camps, and we've got to help them. And I said, you write letters home telling your families about it. Tell them to send packages, food, clothing, I said, even lipstick for the morale of the girls, and have them wrap them and address them to me, you know, Chaplain Bonin. And also I said, if any of your family is here, we will send a letter to the family, and so we can get it to directly to their family here. And but the way we would do it, see, I was using army mails, which you really shouldn't do ordinarily. I said, have them write the name of the family on the
package,
and then put another wrapper with my name on it.
I see.
So when the packages would come in, I'd tear off my name, and then I would see to it that the family got it. Well, anyway, this shaliach from the Israel says to me, you know, I understand that you're getting these packages. And I said, yes. He said, well, you know what the people here are telling me? They're telling me that you open the packages and your families are sending brand new clothing, and you take out the brand new clothing and you put in dirty rags there. You see, it was during, you remember, that when clothing was rationed here, well, people weren't going out and buying stuff. They sent the used clothing. They accused me of stealing the clothing and substituting the rags. Not rags, I mean, they weren't clothing. Well, when he told me that, I can't describe. I felt that the world was just crumbling on me. But then that thought came to me. In the Torah, it says Moses had a lot of trouble with the Jews, you know, in the wilderness. And at one point, he says to them, whose donkey did I steal? I mean, things like that. So I said, oh, Moses must have been accused by the Jews of stealing. So who am I to complain?
Yeah.
I really, this is the thought that went, and it was a comforting thought to me that after all I had tried to do, that they were accusing me of stealing their stuff and substituting the...
It must have been an absolutely devastating feeling.
I can't describe it. I have nightmares about it. He said to me, how could you do this? Well, when I explained the situation to him, he says, well, you know, we're doing what we're doing to save the Jews here. He said, I understand what you're talking about. We're not doing it for them, we're doing it for their children. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how much of this should go in here, because it puts me in the position of saying nasty things about my people.
And I understand.
But
as I type it, I'll feel it. Maybe before we go on, maybe we ought to just stop it.
I can say without exaggeration that despite the many heartaches that came about because of it, the outstanding part of my life was to be there when the Jews, the displaced persons, needed me, and when I was fortunately in a position to be able to help them. I would not be doing justice to my assistant if I did not mention him. His name was Eli Heimberg, H-E-I-M-B-E-R-G. He was my assistant. Chaplains were given a driver for the Jeep, was at our disposal, to be used, of course, for military purposes. And Heimberg was how shall I put it? He now lives in New Bedford, where he is a very successful businessman. And when we first met, he came to see me, coming to see his chaplain, and I was taken by him, and I asked him if he would become my assistant. Until that time, I had had a Christian assistant, which wasn't the best arrangement for a Jewish chaplain. So he came with me and started off as my driver and doing little things that an assistant might do. But when we came to the displaced person's situation, it was invaluable. The great problem, and I may have mentioned it before, with the DPs was that there were hundreds and hundreds of them just sitting around doing nothing and vegetating. It isn't so much that there was nothing to do, but that was only part of the story. If they were asked to do something that they didn't care to do, especially if it involved physical labor, they would brush it aside and say, "We will not do it. We worked enough when we were in the concentration camp. We're not going to work anymore." Even though the so-called work was for their benefit. I'll give you one example. The displaced persons rightfully complained about the monotony of the diet they had. They didn't have any fresh vegetables or anything of that sort. And we were able to arrange to get a shipment of potatoes. And I was overjoyed when I saw the trucks come up with the potatoes. And the sergeant who was with the trucks came over to me and he said, "Chaplain, my boys are completely exhausted. We've been traveling all day. We got the potatoes. They had to load them. And now, could you have these men help unload them?" So I went into the building where they were housed and I asked them to come and unload them. They refused to do so. They said that they worked enough in the concentration camp. And the ill will that was created there, you can imagine, when these soldiers were ordered to unload these things and they saw these able-bodied Jewish men standing around and doing nothing. I'm telling you this, not that I enjoy telling it, but I think it's important to know what happens to people when they are in concentration camps. They lose their pride, they aren't the same people that they were before. And we had to cope with this. Now, I come back to Heimberg, as I say, he was an efficiency expert. We talked the matter over and we felt that we had to give these men and women something to do to keep them busy. We had already found out that just saying thank you to them or praising their work was not going to solve the problem. We had to have some kind of incentive that they would really appreciate. So we set up a miniature economic system. And we said to the people, "We're going to give you work, and we are going to pay you for the work, not in money, but in scrip. We are going to evaluate what certain jobs are. If you do it, we'll give you this piece of paper. We're going to set up a store. Now, what are we going to sell?" I think I mentioned the fact that I had asked the Jewish soldiers to write home and have their family send the materials. Well, this was our stock and trade. And if you wanted something, you had to earn it. You would come in, we had the things priced, so many points, rather than dollars or cents, it was points. And if you had points, you were able to go into a store. Now, the important part about this was that it put so many people to work. The warehouse people, the We had girls typing thank you letters to the families. Then we were able to get some typewriters, and every kind of possible work that could be established, we did, and it was paid for.
Were you communicating always in Yiddish?
Yes. It was a good thing I was able to speak Yiddish. And as I think I may have mentioned, we had such a variety of goods to sell, so to speak, that when we wrote to America to the parents of the soldiers, we even included lipstick, because we felt the girls needed their morale, etc. And this was something that the general began to take great pride in. It was in his domain, and as it worked out later, the general was really praised by his superior, because things were going smoothly at last, whereas in the other camps there was plenty of trouble.
This was in Austria, wasn't it?
This was in Austria.
Now, these people were transported from Dachau to Austria.
Yes. And yes, they were transported. And they came from various countries. Actually, the displaced persons had been shipped towards Dachau to be exterminated, actually.
Was Dachau considered the worst, or Treblinka?
I don't think Dachau was the worst. I think Treblinka was probably... And as far as I can remember, many of the displaced persons who were in Dachau were not there originally. They were in another camp. But as the war progressed, the Russians were making strides forward. These DPs were moved into Germany from Austria. Mm-hmm. And that's how they found themselves there.
You were heading this little business with your friend Mr. Heinberg.
Yes.
Do you still see him?
Oh yes, not often, but we communicate. As a matter of fact, I have been in touch with the Rainbow Division organization, and they asked me if I knew Heinberg, because I had told him of this thing that I had written that had been published, the Moonlight Ride of General Collins, and he had sent for it, so he became a member as a result. So it's interesting that they asked me if I...
if you knew Heinberg.
Now,
how long did you stay in this place in Germany, in Austria?
It's hard for me to
remember. Was it a couple of years?
No, it wasn't a couple of years. I would say it'd be a year or a year and a half.
And then what happened when the camps broke up? Where were these people sent? To Israel, for the most part?
That's an interesting story. Theoretically, they were supposed to go to Israel, but many of them, large number of them, and this distressed us, chose to go to the United States. We had visitors, official visitors from Israel, come to treat these people. Come to Israel, but they felt that the life in Israel would probably be hard, and it would be better in America. There existed then a secret organization of Jews called the Bericha. And the Bericha was a clandestine organization which was sneaking Jews across the border into Italy from Austria. And in Italy, from Italy, they could go to America.
But they entered the United States.
They could go to Israel.
Oh.
The Bricha wanted them to go to Israel. But as I say, many of them preferred to go to the United States. Now, at that time, England did not want us to let the Jews go to Palestine. The United States was an ally of Great Britain, so they had to go along with them and prevent Jews from moving to Palestine. There were ways, what is it, they were called the Moonlight Express or something,
yeah.
Of that sort. And these people of the Bricha were the most marvelous people in the world. They risked their lives. They were all so haggard looking. They didn't sleep nights. They were doing everything they could to help the Jews, and secretly we were helping them. We were not allowed to. Our orders were that we had to prevent the Jews from moving away from Austria. But we found ways of helping the Bricha.
Who were these people that made up the Bricha?
They were Israelis.
Oh.
Who were sent by the Israeli government to do this.
Were you able to establish any kind of relationships with the people in the camp so that it was a kind of a sustaining relationship? Like, do you ever hear from any of them today?
I don't hear from them now. We had a good relationship with most of them. With a few of them we had problems, but most of them were... I don't know whether I showed you the farewell...
Yes, Alan had just showed it to me.
When I left, I guess there was an outpouring of affection that was even greater than it had been before, because there were times when I had to lay the law down to them, because otherwise I knew the general was going to clamp down on them. This was the most difficult part of it all, where I was caught between obeying the military procedure rules and at the same time trying to help the Jews, and it wasn't always possible to do.
Yeah. You had to make decisions.
Had it been known what Heimberg and I were doing, we could have been court-martialed. Fortunately, our general was very sympathetic to our working with the DPs.
This was your favorite general?
Yes, well, he was the only general I had any contact with. But, of course, it worked out to his great benefit, because he came out as the shining light. He didn't have riots in his area.
And there were riots in other places.
Oh, yes, very serious riots. And as I think I had mentioned, I probably showed you these newspaper clippings,
yes,
where they were behind the barbed wire, etc., or in our case, they didn't have them behind the barbed wire. And
so now, after the war, when you came home, you went back to Buffalo.
Yes.
And how long did you stay there at that point?
About 2 years.
And it was at that point, were you the main rabbi there in Buffalo?
When I left for the army, yes. I was replaced temporarily by a rabbi who had just come out of the seminary, and he stayed there until
you got back.
I came back, yes.
And then you resumed your duties.
Left.